Thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Hospice New Zealand Genesis Oncology Trust Lecture number 6. Our thanks to Genesis Oncology Trust for their continued sponsorship, which allows us to bring you these lectures. This morning, there will be a presentation followed by a question and answer session. I must advise you that this conference is being recorded, and at this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Our speaker today is Dr. Bruce Rumbold. Bruce Rumbold is Director of the Palliative Care Unit at La Trobe University in Melbourne. There, he coordinates health-promoting palliative care and spiritual care academic programs, alongside developing public health approaches to end-of-life care. Bruce was a popular presenter at the 2012 Hospice New Zealand Conference, and we are delighted he is able to share more of his work with us today. Welcome, Bruce. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Vijay, and good morning, everyone. Slide one, I guess, is paying my dues to the university by showing the livery, as it were, and the theme that I want to talk about is compassionate communities. And some of you who did attend last year's conference will actually be recognize at least some of these slides, although I suspect in a somewhat different order. So turning to slide two, which is the outline, what I want to cover really is to begin at the end, in a moment or so, to say basically what is the nub of what I'm trying to say, and then, in a sense, go back and start to creep back up on it in terms of where we're coming from. Because what I'm doing today is not talking in detail about nuts and bolts of strategies for public health approaches. These are enormously various, and there's at least some literature around about that. Rather, what I want to do is to try to talk a bit more about the thinking behind it, about why a public health approach is useful and, in my opinion, necessary for end-of-life care. So those are the sorts of themes I want to look at. We're talking about where we've come from in hospice and palliative care, why public health approaches are needed in palliative care today, what some of these implications are for thinking about and working with community death and dying, and how it might shift or revision some of the ways in which we care. So going to the next slide, slide three, the end type of argument, is that in really today, most people spend their dying time, that is the time at which they are living with the illnesses which will bring their life to an end, they spend it in community, that is with their families and their workmates and their friends. And the formal healthcare system, while it might support them in some ways to keep on living, actually is not involved in the details of that living. It's a fairly obvious point, isn't it? But nevertheless, think a bit more about it. Even in community-based palliative care, in my state, Victoria, the average length of stay in a community-based palliative care program is 119 days. During that time, the average number of interventions received is something like 30, and some of those may well be phone calls as well as visits. So with the best will in the world, out of 119 days, 118 and a half are spent being cared for by somebody other than the palliative care team. And we really actually don't know much about who those people are. I guess it varies from person to person, but it's going to be a spouse, children, neighbours, friends, the network of people around the person dying in community is quite often an extensive and overlooked asset or resource. And we tend still to put all our energy into trying to train professionals to improve their strategies, to improve their approach, to improve their skills. But if you think about those 118 and a half days, really one of the ways to improve the care of the dying is to put some energy into improving the care in community. or the care of the community. So to continue that sort of idealistic theme, slide four picks up some characteristics of what a compassionate community might be like. They come from Alan Kelleher's book called Compassionate Cities, and I guess that's sort of the key document, in a sense, as that I'll come to in a little while. But it's about seeing compassion as something which is an ethical imperative, something which our communities need, that it is an attitude that takes into account the particular needs of people who are often at the margins, people living with loss and diminishment. That to do this, we need a strong commitment to social and cultural difference. We need to involve the people who know, that is the grief and palliative care services, in local government policy and planning. So one of the tests of good policy is, what does it do? What is its impact upon people who are aging and dying and grieving? How, in that sense too, does a community diversify its strategies to support people in a whole variety of different ways rather than just the ways that are somewhat standardized and often anchored in the health services? And continuing this list on slide five, how do we include other communities that are often marginalized? In New Zealand, you do this much better than we do in Australia in terms of the inclusion of Maori culture within the overall culture. But I suppose even to put it in that way, the inclusion of Maori culture is to make the point that in some ways there is a dominant culture and another one which is not adequately integrated or equally participative. How do we provide easy access to grief and palliative care services? How does the community manage this? How do we work together, accept overall the responsibility of the changes that we make within our community and our society? How do we keep alive the traditions and storytellers of our communities? And as I said, that comes from Kelleher's Compassionate Cities. A gloriously idealistic vision in one sense, and yet it seems to me that we need to have some sense of what a good society might be like in order to shape and fashion and direct our care. Okay, so with slide six, I move backwards, as it were, into the business of why argue for an attitude like this, or why make this a way of trying to approach palliative care? And slide six, of course, takes us to the two of the patron saints of palliative care. On the left, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. On the right, Dame Cicely Saunders. And these two women, of course, have been extremely influential over the last 40 years in shaping Western ideas about dying. Cicely Saunders got her vision in the 50s, I think it was, of a better way of dying. And in pursuit of that, she trained as a medical practitioner and used her extensive social network to set up the first modern hospice in St. Christopher's in London, and that remains a centre of excellence. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, as a psychiatrist, came from a different angle and started to try to talk to dying people and find out what the actual experience, the emotional experience of dying was like. And in a sense, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's ideas captured, at least for a time, the media. And back in the 70s, for those who are old enough to remember that, there was an absolute flood of literature around the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross stages of dying stuff. Cicely Saunders provided a structure to do something sensible about it, and that's where hospice began. But in slide seven, some of the themes of that sort of revival were are set down. Both of them, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and Cicely Saunders, really emphasized almost like a hero's journey sort of idea of dying. There's emphasis on independence and autonomy and people making a journey. And that's a quote from Cicely Saunders looking back on hospice in 1996. Openness, mind together with heart, deep concern for the freedom of each individual to make a journey to ultimate goals. Very 1970s, really, that sort of idea of self-actualization and fulfillment in all of life, including dying. It was also a movement, hospice movement, which began at the fringes of the health services. And in fact, quite deliberately, Cicely Saunders again says, we moved out of the National Health Service so that attitudes and knowledge could move back in. And clearly here she has behind it the idea that if you can actually get at arm's length enough from a health service that doesn't really want to know about dying and death, if you can get at arm's length and set up something that really works, then it will become so convincing that it will be able to move back in and take over and shape the way in which all care is delivered within healthcare services. So there was a sort of utopian vision within the hospice movement. And thirdly, again a fairly obvious one, the hospice movement was largely around out-of-time dying, that is, the dying which was taking place then of largely of cancer and involving people who were dying early, that is in their 40s and 50s and 60s. And most of the early stories are stories of family people, people embedded in families and how families support them in their dying. There was almost no attention back in the earlier days of hospice to the normal mode of dying, which is people dying of old age and often without the sort of family resources. And perhaps it's a bit ironic, but it's only in the last 10 years that hospice, that is palliative care, have really engaged properly with gerontology or the strategies of aging. The two disciplines started in the 70s. They grew up alongside each other. They hardly talked to each other until the last 10 years. So slide 8, the reminder that, in a sense, hospice did make its journey back into the health system, as Cicely Saunders had envisaged, but the journey back was rather different than the journey that she hoped for. By the mid-80s, it was becoming just too difficult to maintain hospice as a grassroots community movement that it began as. And increasingly, hospices began to look away around for ways of making themselves sustainable and continuing, and they needed funding, and they turned to the health services, the health system, as an ally. And the process, which we often call mainstreaming, I fear, was one in which hospice moved into the health systems of most Western countries and usually adopted the name palliative care at that stage, although palliative care came out of Canada much earlier than that. But the process of mainstreaming, you know, of hospice becoming palliative care, was one which shaped palliative care to the health system as much as, probably more than, I think, the health system taking on palliative care values. And so some of the ideals of hospice began to shift from this business of freedom to journey, the health system emphasis on knowledgeable consumer, much more emphasis on the technologies, shall we say, particularly physical and emotional care, and less upon the social and spiritual dimensions. The focus on out-of-time deaths, however, still tended to continue, and mainstreaming, in at least a number of countries, tended to make the palliative care services less in touch with the local communities that had given them birth. That is, that the services became less directly accountable to their local communities, more accountable to a centralized health service. Organizational units tend to get bigger, etc., etc. And in many respects, I'd argue, we move from the ideal of a good death more toward a managed death. And you see that, I guess, in terms of the emphasis on pathways and various ways of organizing dying within the contemporary palliative care system. You'll understand, of course, that I'm making all sorts of glorious generalizations here, and I guess that's what a sociologist's job is in some respects. But hopefully you can also see that there is a particular, at least some validity in those generalizations. Okay, turning to slide 9, I guess that's the summary of what I've already been saying, that as hospice moved to becoming palliative care, and I understand within your system you have some hospices which are, have at least a bit more of an arm's length relationship, a little bit more like the British model, and you probably sit uneasily somewhere within this movement as a result. But that shift of focus of accountability, that conformation, and inevitably with those, with clinical priorities beginning to dominate approaches to care, hospice is still struggle, I think, within that relationship with the health system. Slide 10 then picks up what I'd argue are the underdeveloped areas of palliative care as a consequence of mainstreaming. That is the holistic vision of hospice, when it hits the health system, becomes somewhat skewed, and we begin to pay less attention to social science and public health perspectives, to the social and spiritual dimensions, to early stage care, to care for those with life-threatening, not just terminal illness. And a lot of our strategies or a lot of our issues in palliative care today about ways of trying to maintain or restore some of these social and spiritual dimensions to try to get palliative care introduced early into treatment scenarios and so forth. But nevertheless, the issue is, in slide 11, that dying and grieving continue to be seen primarily as healthcare concerns. And this has consequences. The consequences of some of them are in slide 12. But still, when we look at dying and grieving, the dominant stories around are what health professionals and health programs can do. Another is that the social issues which were there and identified very early on in the so-called revival, that is the work of Kubler-Ross and Cicely Saunders et al., they are still issues today. Issues around communication, the very early work in the 60s of Glaser and Strauss around the way in which dying was shaped by communication strategies is still topical, even if some of the details have shifted. It's also the case that in a number of places around the world, the re-medicalization of dying, which has taken place in palliative care, has triggered what appear to be virtually second-generation hospice movements. That is, we're now getting another generation of people coming out of palliative care because it's become too medical, and they're wanting to set up different models, community-based models. It's like 1970s all over again in that sense. And we still have this, Paul Callaghan called the indignity of dying with dignity, again, even back in the 70s, where he talked about the way in which, while hospice rhetoric was about people finding their own journey to their ultimate goals, in reality, there was a dominant ethos and a dominant series of values and a dominant way. And by and large, the emotional pressure, at least within hospice, this is U.S. hospice he's talking about, was to die in a particular way, and that in itself was a a major social or structural pressure. And so I think I want to argue that the dominant storyline of palliative care is something which can support at least a minority of contemporary deaths really well, but it still renders the majority of deaths in our societies problematic because they don't actually conform easily to this narrative. Not everybody, in fact, the majority of people, don't really see their lives in terms of a quest for ultimate goals. The majority of people don't have the sort of support that ideally this hospice vision might envisage. Most contemporary dying is much more complicated than some of the way in which hospice identified what was almost like a predictable trajectory from diagnosis toward death. Nowadays, that has become much more complex as cancer moves from being a predictable downward trajectory to a chronic illness with the ups and downs that look actually a little bit more like heart failure or heart disease trajectories than the old cancer trajectories. I guess in that sense, you could, if you wanted to be harsh, argue that palliative care has failed the hospice experiment insofar as it hasn't actually transformed the health system. And part of the reason it hasn't transformed the health system is because it has located itself within the health system and lost some touch to some degree with the communities which gave it birth. So turning to slide 13, which is a slide that's already been up front. The majority of time, again, we remember, the majority of dying time or time of living with life-threatening illness is spent, for most people, outside the health system. That is, healthcare practitioners are not the dominant people in these networks that support people. There's been some interesting work done in New South Wales here where colleagues have recruited networks of people who cared for somebody dying in community. But they recruited them not through palliative care services, they recruited them through local newspapers. And they looked at the characteristics of those networks. And they found some really interesting things, including the ways in which those networks shifted around when one of their people was dying. In other words, these were natural pre-existing networks. Some of the dynamics changed as they began to care for one of their members who was dying. But overall, it was a really important experience for those people. It strengthened the networks. There were health practitioners in those networks, although they tended to be somewhat marginal figures. They weren't central to the care. They were important resources, but they were not the key people. And most of those networks had a story to tell, which was a sort of like a push-pull relationship with health services. That is, they needed the support of healthcare practitioners, but they often found that they had to resist those services as well, because the services were set up to take over, and they needed to be able to keep some sort of distance, some sort of autonomy, in order to maintain their own care for their network member who was dying. So that's an example, I guess, of those stories of informal care. And we don't hear much of them in our public discussion, and certainly not within the palliative care literature. So slide 14, after this lengthy skirmish, why involve public health? Well, part of the reason to involving public health is because if in actual fact dying and grieving are seen largely as healthcare concerns, public health is a tool for beginning to broaden the perspective, for getting back to a wider, more community-engaged view of the human experiences of dying and grieving and living with loss. And in that sense, public health has the potential to begin to restore some of the hospice vision and its original practice, because it is something which takes seriously the contribution of clinical services. It's not a way of trying to get rid of clinical services, for goodness sake. It's a matter of actually, however, complementing and perhaps broadening the horizons again, because it pays attention to these dominant voices, but also tries to pick up things that aren't being said, the experiences that aren't being included. It looks at why we've got to the situation we're in and how we might change it, and it lives with a tension between problem and possibilities. That is, public health much more readily introduces an assets-based approach, whereas our healthcare services, by their very nature, are problem-oriented. And that continuing tension between problem and possibility is something that public health, at its best at least, maintains, and one that I want to sort of explore a bit more now. Turning to slide 15 then, one of the key ideas in public health, well, it's the key idea in social views in general, is the business of the relationship between agency and structure, between the choices we can make and the chances which frame those choices. Bit of an abstract idea, isn't it? But in that sense, agency is about what we can get away with, what we can do, our freedoms. Structure is about our constraints. And every society juggles these qualities. One of the dilemmas of most social structures is that certain people have much more agency than others, and the structures reinforce those differences. The other idea I put alongside that is that community is what mediates agency and structure, choices and chances in people's lives, and that what we need from our community at each stage of our life is these things of confirmation and challenge and continuity, that is, to be accepted for what we are, offered a vision what we might become, be reminded of where we have been. And that's always been one of the contributions of the hospice movement, taken up into palliative care, and that is that it provides some ideas of what might be in this final stage of our lives, that we're not just looking back, we're not just dealing with what's happening, we have at least some way of grasping onto possibility, keeping possibility and hope alive within this end-of-life experience. Obviously, in previous centuries, this was framed in religious ways. Now, in a secularized healthcare system, we struggle often to deal with or keep alive possibility within the experience of dying. That sort of hopelessness is probably why death and dying were not talked about within our healthcare system. Palliative care at least tries to re-establish a language and some sense of quest of possibility of hope within the broader system. Slide 16 is picking this up more generally. The social talking about social determinants is talking about the structures that constrain people's agency. And it's not exactly rocket science. The constraints upon our lives are very much connected with the circumstances in which we born and grow up and live and work and age, and when it comes to health, with the systems that we have available to us through our community, our society. And these, of course, are shaped by these wider forces of economics and social policy and politics. This also applies to the way in which end of life is shaped within our societies. The social determinants identify usually a gradient or a range of people different experiences for people, and these also include the way in which people experience their dying and approach the end of their lives. So slide 17 picks that up, this idea of a social gradient, that all societies have got a social hierarchies, that all societies, at least, yeah, I think we can carry that out as that's a universal generalization, all societies have a gradient in health, so it's better at the top than the bottom. Most diseases are also concentrated in earlier ages at the bottom. That is, when it comes to palliative care, certain groups of people within society die earlier, and that their approach to dying is characterized by more chronic illness than people at the top. And I don't have New Zealand figures, but here's the a UK graph around that. The top line is life expectancy mapped against social class, from the most deprived at the left-hand side to the least deprived at the right-hand side. And the bottom line is of where disability begins to set in, so that you see a differential of about 10 years between the bottom and the top social class or socioeconomic status in terms of dying. That is, people in really in deprived neighborhoods on average die 10 years earlier than those in the least deprived. But in terms of disability, there's a 20-year gap. And people in the most deprived neighborhoods have a 20-year disability or 20 years of disability prior to death on average, as against the 10 years of the most the least deprived neighborhoods. So there is an issue of equity or of justice within this social approach to health and illness and death and dying. The heavy bar across the bottom, across the middle of the graph, is just to do with, because I pinched the graph from an article that was talking about what might be the impact of raising the retirement age. And I guess that's what it would be taking it from 65 to 67 in the UK. And as you can see, more than half the population would be on disability pensions before they actually got to retirement, if that was the case. So, slide 19, trying to gather or sum that up a little bit. If we're going to pursue in health, we need to look at the causes, but not only the causes, but the causes of the causes and the causes of the causes of the causes, if you could give that. By that I mean is that on our death certificates, we tend to have a particular cause of death, which is something that's in ICD-10. You're not actually allowed to die of anything. It's not listed in the manual in some respect. But we also know that the causes of those causes of death are often to do with habits or behaviours. Smoking is one of the most obvious ones, alcohol abuse, physical inactivity, etc., etc. Those are lifestyle issues which shape causes of the causes of dying. But we also, in a broad social perspective, need to ask the question about why do people make these lifestyle choices? And quite clearly, they are constrained or influenced by social and economic circumstance because they follow this sort of social patterning. So it's the causes of the causes of the causes that we need to pay attention to, the structural issues which affect or constrain the agency of people, which cause them often to make choices which are against their better interests. So this is where this agency and structure or causes of the causes of the causes stuff becomes important. And that stuff also shapes the way we live our lives, the way in which we die. And in that respect, if we're going to have comprehensive and effective end-of-life services, we need this broader vision, this broader understanding. But it will begin not just, it can't really begin only within the palliative care services. It needs to take shape across the health services And for that to happen, it also actually has to become a whole social approach, an all of society approach. Okay, slide 20. How would this broad way of thinking in terms of public health thinking that I've sort of presented in a rather inarticulate way, I figure, how might it impact upon palliative care? Well, Alan Kelleher, I guess, has been the lead thinker in this. Alan, who actually set up the unit that I now direct and has been in the UK and then Canada, is back in Middlesex, I think, later this year, took hold of two standard public health models and applied them to palliative care. Health promoting palliative care applies the Ottawa Charter approach to healthy policy formation, to palliative care, and healthy settings idea is behind Compassionate Cities, where he takes, as I said, these two standard public health models and applies them to end-of-life care. So slide 21 picks up the aim of health promoting palliative care. It is basically, again, to restore something of the hospice vision to the palliative care scenario. And slide 22 gathers that up. The link, I guess, is that, or the argument is, that we need health-promoting palliative care services, that is, palliative care services that take on board the principles of health promotion, to see their role to share their learning and their discoveries and their experiences with the community in which they're embedded. That's necessary in order to begin to create and contribute to compassionate communities. Another assertion, though, I want to make is that in order to realize the vision of a compassionate community, end-of-life care needs to be coordinated outside the health services if we're going to have genuine and sustainable community change take place. That is, communities need to be able to make decisions about how they use their resources, about how they care, and not just simply delegate that to the health services. And a third issue around the public health approach is that it asks us to, or invites us to, think about death in human development. That is, in what sense can dying be healthy? And that language is still pretty strange in most of today's health services. So health-promoting palliative care itself has got a particular jangle about it, and quite deliberately it's cognitive dissonance. And yet hospice and the idea of good death are really about the idea of dying as a something which can be done in a healthy or a whole fashion, not merely as a capitulation to illness or old age. Slide 23 sums up those public health perspectives or one of the ideas about health. More than the absence of disease and disability, it's something that's created by participation. It requires a healthy setting or a healthy environment. It's about providing much more than health services because it involves the way in which we live our lives, organize our work, carry out our economics, play our sport, etc., etc. And it is an approach which addresses both individual and structural aspects of society. Slide 24, though, also picks up a couple of caveats. First of all, public health is not the same as psychosocial care. There's a lot of language around psychosocial care in healthcare today, but by and large, it is psychosocial. That is, it is essentially sheeting home social discoveries to individuals. That is, we know that smoking is a problem and therefore you shouldn't do it. We know that physical inactivity and obesity are issues, so carry out some healthy eating. We don't actually look at the structural issues behind these individual requirements which we place on people. So in some ways, a psychosocial care actually can end up being a form of blaming rather than of understanding what shapes people's behaviours. Second comment, taking on a public health perspective is not asking health services to do even more. It's about asking health services to consider what they need to contribute to a society's public health program. What can we as palliative care services provide to our societies or to our communities so that they take on board some of the responsibility which they rightly might take, so that they might play their role? What can we facilitate? What can we encourage? What can we tell people about end of life which might encourage them to make better decisions earlier on in their experiences? And in case that sounds like trying to delegate or reduce healthcare input, a community development approach is not about providing more professional services, but it's not necessarily about providing less. So slide 25 reminds us of some of the dilemmas in taking a public health approach. One of the first is that, as we know, access to healthcare, which is largely illness care, doesn't necessarily result in health. It's a good idea to have healthcare, but it doesn't necessarily make us healthy. We also know that social inequality is a key negative determinant of health, that it is becoming increasingly hard to change the structures around health and illness and death and dying because of the declining ownership of public services. We organise through government contract rather than provide those services. And if you get the contract wrong, it makes it harder and harder to make the changes. Our contemporary focus on risk further individualises the social determinants of health. As I said, we have risk factors like smoking and obesity and inactivity and so forth, which we sheet home to individuals rather than ask ourselves, how does this happen? Why does our society create these things? And the tension, I guess, that is always within our health services or health budgeting is that community development approaches, health promotion approaches, are much more health than income related. And they go to the margins of healthcare services because health service thinking is about fixing problems, about treating illness. And that's why only 5% of our budgets, healthcare budgets, tends to be on prevention, 95% on trying to fix the problems which might have been prevented had we addressed them a little bit earlier on. So slide 26. The sort of questions that a public health perspective opens up to us, I'd suggest, would include some of these. How might people die in ways that are appropriate to the ways that they've lived? That's not always good news, I suspect. People have stuffed up their lives, stuffed up their living, often stuff up their dying as well. But I guess in one sense that's at least a little bit more realistic to think about it in those ways. More positively, how might people continue to support the and care for their dying friends and family members and neighbours? How can we make more prominent the stories of informal care, the everyday stories, the stories of those 118 and a half days in which people are supported in their homes by friends and neighbours and colleagues? And importantly, how can we liberate the knowledge about human dying that's been accumulated in the health systems? How can we get it back into the community? I think that is beginning to happen more. But nevertheless, we have a situation still where palliative care as the place where communities have chosen to put their dying, that is, the responsibility has been given to palliative care services, then how do we actually take some of that knowledge and expertise and experience and hand it back, give it back into the communities? So looking ahead at slide 27, it seems to me there are three particular challenges that we need to take on board. And when I look at it, I've gone got my timing, as ever, badly wrong, haven't I? But very quickly, looking at these, I think that we have to look again at the way in which we organise labour and the way in which formal and informal care are related. I think we have to take a health assets approach. I think we have to focus more on compassionate care. And turning to slide 28, picking up some of the division of labour stuff, I've already referred to the way in which in social management of dying and grief, the experience of those informal or natural networks caring for members, there was tension between the informal networks and the formal networks that were geared up to take control. And I think we need to find ways of almost inverting the responsibility, where we can make health services available to networks in the community so that they can choose and engage aspects of them, so that they can go in and out of relationships, so that they can time it in the way that they need it rather than the way that health services think they should deliver it. One of the dilemmas we have, I think, too, and I don't know necessarily about New Zealand, but one of our dilemmas of voluntarism even, is that what we tend to do is to take hold of volunteers and train them and manage them in such a way that they become an extension of a health service rather than a member of their community. That is, we take a member of the community, of the neighbourhood, and we train them, and we then put upon them requirements that they should not spend more than a certain time, they should not make a certain more visits, that they must report this and that, etc., etc. We actually, as I said, turn them into extensions of professionals rather than members of community. And in so doing, we seem to have an elevated idea of professional care. We forget that it actually isn't a guarantee of safety. And we end up with formal and informal care side by side, but actually not really able to work properly with each other. So that's one of those dilemmas. A second one is the need to look at assets. By and large, in our health service thinking is to identify problems and rush in and try to fix them. We often don't ask the question about what's going for this person, what do we need to strengthen, what do we need to encourage, what do we need to support, how can we help to reinforce the support that they already have and not risk taking initiatives which disengage or disable that report, that support. How can we focus on possibilities? How can we provide compassionate care? I'm going to whip through most of these other slides, I'm afraid. I apologize for getting lost on track. I'm actually not a morning person. This is one of the problems, I'm afraid. So turning to slide 30, one of the things that's returning to healthcare language in a big way in the last couple of years is compassion. But that's a really strong idea, a really helpful idea. But there also creates some problems, slide 31, because there's all this rhetoric about compassion, but it's largely placed in services which structurally lack it. How can healthcare practitioners be compassionate if the workplace isn't compassionate, if the health service isn't compassionate, if the society isn't compassionate? So one of our dilemmas is slide 32, creating compassionate spaces, and that involves thinking in a different way about the way in which we do society. It also, I want to argue, this is slide 33, begins to involve us in understanding that compassion is fundamentally a spiritual practice. And to that end, we need to look at how spirituality functions and operates within the contemporary world. Slide 30, what is it? 34, is it? I will just basically jump over. Slide 35 reminds us that spirituality is fundamentally around things like identity and community and meaning and purpose, and that in palliative care services increasingly, slide 36, we're beginning to monitor those sorts of things at the individual level. And strategies for spiritual care, 37, are linked up. Sorry, that's 36, isn't it? No, 37 are linked up with supporting those aspects of life. But there's also a communal aspect, slide 38, to spirituality. And that's around what's a good life, what's a good society, what's a good death. Those are the contexts in which people are able to answer their own questions about identity and community and purpose. So, slide 39. Religious traditions have always understood that reflecting upon death is a way in which we learn to make good decisions in life. In today's society, palliative care services are the place in which reflection upon dying and death is paramount. But it's a gift that we need to be able to give back to the societies in which we operate. And so these next few slides, slide 40 picks up what sort of society might we contribute to creating. 41, the capabilities of a society like this. 42, the tasks to which palliative care services can contribute. 43, strategies. How might we do it? And this is getting onto the public health strategy, which is, I guess, encapsulated in part in Alan Kelleher's books. But there are things which we need to do as palliative care services to hand back some of our knowledge and insight. There are things which we can facilitate as palliative care services within our communities, often by encouraging others to take on board some of that knowledge and run with it. And there are things which we need to engage with as a society about why is it that particular end-of-life services, palliative care services, hospice services are still skewed in their presentation to only some people, and to ask ourselves questions about how we might use our natural networks in support even better. Slide 44 is finally a reference to what might actually be useful, some of the resources that are around in terms of strategies for developing public health approaches. The PCV stuff is material which we've worked with here in Victoria. The second one, the Public Health Palliative Care site, is the site of the recent conferences in public health and palliative care. And there's an International Association for Public Health and Palliative Care in formation now as an outcome of the third international conference in Limerick earlier this year. So that, rather belatedly, is where I need to call a halt to it. And look, I'm sorry, I have, as ever, got my balance badly wrong. But Vijay, it's back to you, and at least a short time for some questions or comment.